Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. You're listening to 101.5 on the FM dial. Thank you for tuning in. Our product is entertainment, information, and a sprinkling here and there of amusement. Hope you like it. Well, today, we're going to celebrate the 100th birthday of the Wrigley Building in Chicago. Chicago's most beloved skyscraper once opened the door to the Magnificent Mile, and it still looks terrific. A building is not, of course, a living thing. Unless it's the place you live or work or visit with some regularity, you likely will take most of the city's thousands of buildings for granted. Of course, there are exceptions. A few buildings that you might point out to visiting friends from out of town. Wrigley Field, the Water Tower, the John Hancock Center, and the Sears Tower, regardless of what it's called now. However, what they are now formerly called doesn't really matter. And then there's the Museum of Science and Industry. And these all come quickly to mind on that score of the buildings with character, those places that you remember, that you want to show to your friends. These are the ones that are featured on architectural tours. Buildings such as the Rookery, the Monadnock Building, and of course, there's the Auditorium Theater. But the Wrigley Building is another. It has been in the business of celebrating its 100th birthday this year, and that should remind us of its presence and its importance. The Chicago Theater also turns 100 this year, and its stunning marquee has been lighted for the occasion. For many, that evokes not so much thoughts of the building, but instead memories of events. The Wrigley Building, Chicago is, Sinatra often sang in that tune, My Kind of Town. Blair Kamen, the former architecture critic for the Chicago Tribune and Pulitzer Prize winner for his work, once wrote of the Wrigley Building that no skyscraper in Chicago is more beloved than this one. It can also be argued that no skyscraper was more important. Buildings come and go. We rarely notice. The city always carries on. But celebrity is what we have here. And celebrity in this case is important. Building is the story of the Miracle Mile, of the Magnificent Mile, or whatever one calls it. The building of the Wrigley structure. So take a walk sometime, starting at Michigan Avenue's DuSable Bridge and heading north. The first thing you'll see is the Wrigley Building. The last thing you'll see is the Drake Hotel. That's 101 years old. And among its many, many guests have been mobster Frank Nitti and later Princess Diana. But that's another story altogether. And now we go up to the Arctic, where we find that the Arctic Highway is being opened. The US and Canada are charting new sea lanes as the ice fields thaw. The ship that's doing this is a 420-foot US Coast Guard cutter, Healy. It goes forward, ramming, then backing up and ramming again. The ice is several feet thick. The noise is deafening as cleaved chunks scrape the side of the hull. And below deck, the constant vibration caused by the severing sheet can feel like an earthquake. Yet the bulldozing task here has its moments of beauty too. Some of the ice chunks peeling away from the bow glow with an iridescent blue as if being lit by a flashlight from underneath the sea. The ship's journey is part of a rare transit through the fabled Northwest Passage that is helping the United States project influence in what is one of the most geostrategic and quickly changing places on Earth. With a warming Arctic and polar ice cap in retreat, the rooftop of the world is more navigable than at any time in modern history. And that is opening up the potential for new commercial lanes and the need for better search and rescue expertise, for enhanced environmental protection, and indeed cooperation with local populations in the high latitudes. But it has also set off a global race to lay claim to routes and resources in the austere but all-important region. Piloting this ship, the Healy, the bullnose boat, which makes its way through the ice field, takes composure and problem solving, deciding when and how far to veer off a particular path, sometimes weaving, sometimes turning sharply through a multi-year ice field. Other times, the best option is simply to batter ahead. The one thing that icebreaking needs is patience, according to the captain of the ship. That knowledge is one of the main points of this voyage through the Northwest Passage, which was first traversed by a Norwegian explorer, Roald Amundsen, in 1906. And since his first journey, only 318 vessels as of 2020 have successfully crossed it. But more than two-thirds of those crossings have happened in the past 15 years, amid changes that the icebreaker Healy has witnessed. When the ship took its maiden voyage through the Northwest Passage in 2000, the Arctic had about a quarter more ice cover. Looking over time, the trend lines are clear. It's declining by 13% each decade. This melting is part of every consideration and conversation that happens in this part of Canada, from the most profound to the most mundane. Here, for example, in Resolute Bay, one of the most northerly communities in the world, where Inuit were forced to relocate by the Canadian government beginning in 1953 in order to exert sovereignty in the high Arctic. Unstable ice has upended everything from hunting patterns and the availability of food to hockey tournaments normally reached by snowmobile over the frozen ice. At sea, the changes are profound too. The Arctic is warming at twice the rate of the rest of the globe. Some scientists warn that within the next two decades, the waterways could be ice-free in summertime. And that has generated new geostrategic tensions over Russian militarization of the Arctic and a hungry China vying for resources and increased competition for sea lanes. Even this part of the Arctic, though, is contested because Canada views the Northwest Passage as an internal waterway, while the U.S. claims it's an international seaway. For now, at least, the dispute is managed under a 1988 accord that requires the U.S. to seek prior consent from Canada before passage. But tensions flared in recent years. The Americans floated what's called a freedom of navigation operation and called Canada's claim to the Northwest Passage illegitimate. Well, both the U.S. and the Canadian Coast Guards have sought to expand their Arctic capabilities in recent years. The U.S. Coast Guard has only two operable icebreakers. The heavy ship that is aging and requiring expensive upgrades, and the medium cutter Healy. Its polar security cutter, that program foresees three new heavy polar icebreakers, two of which are fully funded now. And the first is currently under contract. Why then the need for more icebreakers? Because presence equals influence. And we have very little presence in the Arctic. A warming Arctic means a more unpredictable one because of ice that is rougher and behaves differently. It also means a more open Arctic, which will bring more cruise liners, more recreational boaters, and more adventurists, for which the Canadian Coast Guard is responsible. You see, Canada's Coast Guard is not part of the Canadian military, as is ours, but it is in charge of search and rescue and environmental protection. And it has expanded its presence here 3 years ago, creating a permanent outpost in Yellowknife, the Northwest Territories. It is doing so in cooperation with allies, but the main mission is to support and cooperate with the Inuit population at the front lines of climate change. Despite the Arctic comprising more than 40% of Canada's land mass, 2/3 of Canadians live within 100 kilometers, at 62 miles, of the U.S. border. The U.S. Arctic region is much smaller and farther away from most Americans, and only about 14% of the Arctic has been mapped. And just completed has been a corridor to the Northwest Passage. While knowing the contours of the sea floor is crucial for vessel safety, everything done here has implications felt well beyond the sea lane. Open waters affect the nature of wind patterns and the transfer of heat far outside the Arctic Circle. Because, you see, the Arctic is having a severe impact on storminess in North America. And a lot of the anomalous weather patterns that we're seeing are really a direct result of that. Yet it is a very complex system of interconnectivity. This is something that we should keep our eyes on and be alert to the developments there. Now, we'll let you take a break for a few minutes, and I'll be right back with a few words about nature. My first words here about nature are, you can be thrilled by what you don't know, or thrilled by what you know and have never seen. If you want to be joyful, you need to be surprised, and often. And to do this, you really need to go outside. There's only so much astonishment you can manufacture for yourself if you're in your house, or worse, in your head, all the time. Yet you might come up with something unexpected in your refrigerator. But if you thought about it, you'd realize you should have seen it coming the moment you stuck the thing into the used yogurt container and shoved it toward the back. But if you're outside, paying even a modicum of attention, something is bound to slap you happy. And with that, that's my introduction to lenticular clouds, or clouds which are lens shaped. They are surpassingly cool. They're saucer-shaped drifts of perfection that form over large objects such as mountains. You may have seen them on a flight west to the Pacific coast, or perhaps flying back from Denver. In any event, they are frequently misidentified as UFOs by people who are insufficiently awestruck by reality. Sometimes they lift off fully formed, one after another, and sail away in stacks. So if you're a cloud searcher, and you're getting points for the ones you identify, the lenticular clouds will give you quite a good score. When you're as close as I have been, you see that there's nothing static about them. Lenticular clouds are a snapshot in water of the air currents over a peak. Water molecules coalesce as the air rises over the obstacle, and they evaporate on the other side as the air current slides down again. That's because as the air slides down, it warms. And when you see it from a distance, the lenticular cloud, it looks like the mountain put a cap on it. But the water in the cloud is constantly renewing itself and trailing away. It's the very illustration of ephemera. So, be on the lookout for lenticular clouds, and you will be elated by nature in a way that you've never known. And now we change from lenticular clouds to fossil footprints of the first Americans. A new study of fossilized footprints has found in New Mexico that humans were living in North America 23,000 years ago, and that's millennia earlier than most scientists once believed. Researchers long debated when humans first arrived in the Americas after spreading out from Africa and Asia. Many believe the first American ancestors migrated as recently as 13,000 years ago by crossing a now submerged land bridge that connected Siberia to Alaska during the last ice age. Others, though, say they arrived about 16,000 years ago, or even up to 30,000 years ago, though there is little evidence in the fossil record to support such claims. But new footprints preserved in an ancient lakeshore in what is now the arid White Sands National Park show that humans were living in the American Southwest at a time when colossal ice sheets would have blocked the path of migrants from Asia. Precisely dating fossilized footprints is exceptionally difficult, but these 61 trackways were interlayered with sediment containing the seeds of plants that once grew along the lake. And radiocarbon dating of the seeds revealed that the footprints were 21 to 23,000 years old. So we've been here a lot longer than we thought. And now, a quick word about coronavirus and air travel. With a few simple policy changes, commercial airlines could better protect their passengers from catching COVID, according to new studies. Thanks in part to highly effective ventilation systems, the chances of viral spread aboard planes remains low, but the risks go up when passengers take off their masks and tuck into flight meals. You might keep that in mind next time you fly. And now, my friends, it looks like we're heading toward the end of our program today. It seems like there's never enough time to cover everything. I wanted to tell you about a planet with three stars, but I'll just have to delay that until we meet again. Remember what I said at the opening, that our product is entertainment, information, and a sprinkling here and there of amusement. I hope you've enjoyed today's show, and we'll come back and rejoin us the next time to hear a little of this, a little of that. You be safe out there. Take care. And we will get through this era. You can count on it. And now it's time for Willie Nelson and I to head on down the road as we look for more items that fit into our format here of a little of this, a little of that. And if there are some things that you'd like to hear about, why, give us a ring and I'll try to see if I can find something for you. So until next time, Dan Dillman signing off and wishing you a very nice week, a sunny week, and a very pleasant fall week as we head toward December. Oh my, Christmas will be here before we know it.